against it. Better to think like the surveyor, with her military training. And clear the area now, even though someone could always come in the front door while I was up there. The back room told a different story than the front rooms did. My imagination could only reconstruct what might have happened in the broadest, crudest terms. Here, stout oak tables had been overturned to form crude defensive barricades. Some of the tables were full of bullet holes, and others appeared half melted or shredded by gunfire. Beyond the remains of the table, the dark splotches across the walls and pooled on the floor told of unspeakable and sudden violence. Dust had settled over everything, along with the cool, flat smell of slow decay, and I could see rat droppings and signs of a cot or a bed having been placed in a corner at some later date, although who could have slept among such reminders of a massacre? Someone, too, had carved their initials into one of the tables. R.S. was here. The marks looked fresher than the rest of it. Maybe you carved your initials when visiting a war monument, if you were insensitive. Here it stank of bravado to drown out fear. The stairs awaited, and to quell my rising nausea, I headed back to them and began to climb. I had put my gun away by then, since I needed that hand for balance, but I wished I had the surveyor's assault rifle. I would have felt safer. It was a strange ascent, in contrast to my descents into the tower. The brackish quality of the light against those graying interior walls was better than the phosphorescence of the tower, but what I found on these walls unnerved me just as much, if in a different way. More bloodstains, mostly thick smudges, as if several people had bled out while trying to escape attackers from below. Sometimes dribbles of blood, sometimes a spray. Words had been written on these walls, but nothing like the words in the tower. More initials, but also little obscene pictures and a few phrases of a more personal nature. Some longer hints of what might have transpired. 4 boxes of foodstuffs, 3 boxes of medical supplies, and drinking water for 5 days, if rationed. Enough bullets for all of us, if necessary. Confessions, too, which I won't document here, but that had the sincerity and weight of having been written immediately before, or during, moments when the individuals must have thought death was upon them. So many needing so much to communicate what amounted to so little. Things found on the stairs, a discarded shoe, a magazine from an automatic pistol, a few moldy vials of samples long rotted or turned to rancid liquid, a crucifix that looked like it had been dislodged from the wall, a clipboard, the wooden part soggy, and the metal part deep orange-red from rust. And worst of all, a dilapidated toy rabbit with ragged ears. Perhaps a good luck symbol smuggled in on an expedition. There had been no children in Area X since the border had come down, as far as I knew. At roughly the halfway point, I came to a landing, which must have been where I had first seen the flicker of light the night before. The silence still dominated, and I had heard no hint of movement above me. The light was better because of the windows to left and right. Here the blood spatter abruptly cut off, although bullet holes riddled the walls. Bullet casings littered the floor, but someone had taken the time to sweep them off to the sides, leaving the path to the stairs above clear. To the left lay a stack of guns and rifles, some of them ancient, some of them not army issue. It was hard to tell if anyone had been at them recently. Thinking about what the surveyor had said, I wondered when I would encounter a blunderbuss or some other terrible joke. Otherwise, there was just the dust and the mold and a tiny square window looking down on the beach and the reeds. Opposite it, a faded photograph in a broken frame dangling from a nail. The smudged glass was cracked and half covered in specks of green mold. The black and white photograph showed 2 men standing at the base of the lighthouse with a girl off to the side. A circle had been drawn with a marker around one of the men. He looked about 50 years old and wore a fisherman's cap. A sharp eagle's eye gleamed out from a heavy face, the left eye lost to his squint. A thick beard hid all but a hint of a firm chin under it. He didn't smile, but he didn't frown either. I'd had experience enough with lighthouse keepers to know one when I saw one. But there was also some quality to him, perhaps just because of the strange way the dust framed his face, that made me think of him as the lighthouse keeper. Or perhaps I'd already spent too much time in that place, and my mind was seeking any answer, even to simple questions. The rounded bulk of the lighthouse behind the three was bright and sharp, the door on the far right in good repair, nothing like what I had encountered, and I wondered when the photo had been taken, how many years between the photograph and the start of it all. How many years had the lighthouse keeper kept to his schedule and his rituals, lived in that community, gone to the local bar or pub? Perhaps he'd had a wife. Perhaps the girl in the photo was his daughter. Perhaps he'd been a popular man, or solitary, or a little of both. Regardless, none of it had mattered in the end. I stared at him from across the years, trying to tell from the moldy photograph, from the line of his jaw and the reflection of light in his eyes, how he might have reacted, what his last hours might have been like. Perhaps he'd left in time, but probably not. Perhaps he was even moldering in the ground floor in a forgotten corner. Or, and I experienced a sudden shudder, maybe he was waiting for me above at the top, in some form. I took the photograph out of its frame, shoved it in my pocket. The lighthouse keeper would come with me, although he hardly counted as a good luck charm. As I left the landing, I had the peculiar thought that I was not the first to pocket the photo, that someone would always come behind to replace it, to circle the lighthouse keeper again. I continued to encounter additional signs of violence the higher I went, but no more bodies. The closer I came to the top, the more I began to have the sense that someone had lived here recently. The mustiness gave way to the scent of sweat, but also a smell like soap. The stairs had less debris on them, and the walls were clean. By the time I was bending over the last narrow stretch of steps out into the lantern room, the ceiling grown suddenly close, I was sure I would emerge to find someone staring at me. So I took out my gun again, but again, no one was there. Just a few chairs, a rickety table with a rug beneath it, and the surprise that the thick glass here was still intact. The beacon glass itself lay dull and dormant in the center of the room. You could see for miles to all sides. I stood there for a moment, looking back the way I had come, at the trail that had brought me, at the shadow in the distance that might have been the village, and then to the right, across the last of the marsh. The transition to scrub land and the gnarled bushes punished by the wind off the sea. They, clinging to the soil, stopped it from eroding and helped bulwark the dunes and the sea oats that came next. It was a gentle slope from there to the glittering beach, the surf, and the waves. A second look, and from the direction of base camp amid the swamp and far distant pines, I could see strands of black smoke, which could have meant anything, but I also could see, from the location of the tower, a kind of brightness of its own, a sort of refracted phosphorescence that did not bear thinking about. That I could see it, that I had an affinity to it, agitated me. I was certain that no one else left here, not the surveyor, not the psychologist, could see that stirring of the inexplicable. I turned my attention to the chairs, the table, searching for whatever might give me insight into anything. After about 5 minutes, I thought to pull back the rug. A square trap door, measuring about 4 feet per side, lay hidden there. The latch was set into the wood of the floor. I pushed the table out of the way with a terrible rending sound that made me grit my teeth. Then, swiftly, in case someone waited down there, I threw open the trapdoor, shouting out something inane like, "I've got a gun!" aiming my weapon with one hand and my flashlight with the other. I had the distant sense of the weight of my gun dropping to the floor, my flashlight shaking in my hand, though somehow I held on to it. I could not believe what I was staring down at, and I felt lost. The trapdoor opened into a space about 15 feet deep and 30 feet wide. The psychologist had clearly been there for her knapsack. Several weapons, bottles of water, and a large flashlight lay off to the left side. But of the psychologist herself, there was no sign. No, what had me gasping for breath, what felt like a punch in the stomach as I dropped to my knees, was the huge mound that dominated the space, a kind of insane midden. I was looking at a pile of papers with hundreds of journals on top of it, just like the ones we had been issued to record our observations of Area X, each with a job title written on the front, each, as it turned out, filled with writing, many, many more than could possibly have been filed by only 12 expeditions. Can you really imagine what it was like in those first moments, peering down into that dark space and seeing that? Perhaps you can. Perhaps you're staring at it now. My third and best field assignment out of college required that I travel to a remote location on the western coast, to a curled hook of land at the farthest extremity from civilization, in an area that teetered between temperate and Arctic climates. Here the earth had disgorged huge rock formations, and an old-growth rainforest had sprouted up around them. This world was always moist, the annual rainfall more than 70 inches a year, and not seeing droplets of water on leaves was an extraordinary event. The air was so amazingly clean and the vegetation so dense, so richly green, that every spiral of fern seemed designed to make me feel at peace with the world. Bears and panthers and elk lived in those forests, along with a multitude of bird species. The fish in the streams were mercury-free and enormous. I lived in a village of about 300 souls near the coast. I had rented a cottage next to a house at the top of a hill that had belonged to 5 generations of fisher folk. A husband and wife, childless, owned the property, and they had the kind of severely laconic quality common to the area. I made no friends there, and I wasn't sure that even long-standing neighbors were friends either. Only in the local pub that everyone frequented, after a few pints, would you see signs of friendliness and camaraderie. But violence lived in the pub, too, and I kept away most of the time. I was 4 years away from meeting my future husband, and at the time I wasn't looking for much of anything from anyone. I had plenty to keep me busy. Every day I drove the hellish winding road, rutted and treacherous even when dry, that led me to the place they called simply Rock Bay. There, sheets of magma that lay beyond the rough beaches had been worn smooth over millions of years and become pitted with tidal pools. At low tide in the morning, I would photograph those tidal pools, take measurements, and catalog the life found within them, sometimes staying through part of high tide, wading in my rubber boots, the spray from the waves that smashed over the lip of the ledge drenching me. A species of mussels found nowhere else lived in those tidal pools, in a symbiotic relationship with a fish called a gartner, after its discoverer. Several species of marine snails and sea anemones lurked there, too, and a tough little squid I nicknamed St. Pugnacious, eschewing its scientific name because the danger music of its white flashing luminescence made its mantle look like a pope's hat. I could easily lose hours there, observing the hidden life of tidal pools, and sometimes I marveled at the fact that I had been given such a gift, not just to lose myself in the present moment so utterly, but also to have such solitude, which was all I had ever craved during my studies, my practice to reach this point. Even then, though, during the drives back, I was grieving the anticipated end of this happiness, because I knew it had to end eventually. The research grant was only for 2 years, and who really would care about mussels longer than that? And it's true, my research methods could be eccentric. These were the kinds of thoughts I'd have as the expiration date came nearer and the prospects looked dimmer and dimmer for renewal. Against my better judgment, I began to spend more and more time in the pub. I'd wake in the morning, my head fuzzy, sometimes with someone I knew, but who was a stranger just leaving, and realize I was one day closer to the end of it all. Running through it, too, was a sense of relief, not as strong as the sadness, but the thought, counter to everything else I felt, that this way I would not become that person the locals saw on the rocks and still thought of as an outsider. "Oh, that's just the old biologist. She's been here for ages, going crazy studying those muscles," she talks to herself, mutters to herself at the bar. "If you say a kind word..." When I saw those hundreds of journals, I felt, for a long moment, that I had become that old biologist after all. That's how the madness of the world tries to colonize you, from the outside in, forcing you to live in its reality. Reality encroaches in other ways, too. At some point during our relationship, my husband began to call me the ghost bird, which was his way of teasing me for not being present enough in his life. It would be said with a kind of creasing at the corner of his lips that almost formed a thin smile, but in his eyes I could see the reproach. If we went to bars with his friends, one of his favorite things to do, I would volunteer only what a prisoner might during an interrogation. They weren't my friends, not really, but also I wasn't in the habit of engaging in small talk, nor in broad talk, as I like to call it. I didn't care about politics except in how politics impinged upon the environment. I wasn't religious. All of my hobbies were bound up in my work. I lived for the work, and I thrilled with the power of that focus. But it was also deeply personal. I didn't like to talk about my research. I didn't wear makeup or care about new shoes or the latest music. I'm sure my husband's friends found me taciturn or worse. Perhaps they even found me unsophisticated or strangely uneducated, as I heard one of them say, although I don't know if he was referring to me. I enjoyed the bars, but not for the same reasons as my husband. I loved the late-night slow burn of being out, my mind turning over some problem, some piece of data, while able to appear sociable but still existing apart. He worried too much about me, though, and my need for solitude ate into his enjoyment of talking to friends, who were mostly from the hospital. I would see him trail off in mid-sentence, gazing at me for some sign of my own contentment, as, off to the side, I drank my whiskey neat. "Ghost bird," he would say later, "did you have fun?" I'd nod and smile. But fun for me was sneaking off to peer into a tidal pool, to grasp the intricacies of the creatures that lived there. Sustenance for me was tied to ecosystem and habitat. Orgasm, the sudden realization of the interconnectivity of living things. Observation had always meant more to me than interaction. He knew all of this, I think, but I never could express myself that well to him, although I did try, and he did listen. And yet, I was nothing but expression in other ways. My sole gift or talent, I believe now, was that places could impress themselves upon me, and I could become a part of them with ease. Even a bar was a type of ecosystem, if a crude one. And to someone entering, someone without my husband's agenda, that person could have seen me sitting there and had no trouble imagining that I was happy in my little bubble of silence. Would have had no trouble believing I fit in. Yet even as my husband wanted me to be assimilated in a sense, the irony was that he wanted to stand out. Seeing that huge pile of journals, this was another thing I thought of, that he had been wrong for the 11th expedition because of this quality, that here were the indiscriminate accounts of so many souls, and that his account couldn't possibly stand out, that in the end he'd been reduced to a state that approximated my own. Those journals, flimsy gravestones, confronted me with my husband's death all over again. I dreaded finding his, dreaded knowing his true account, not the featureless generic mutterings he had given to our superiors upon his return. "Ghost bird, do you love me?" he whispered once in the dark before he left for his expedition training, even though he was the ghost. "Ghost bird, do you need me?" I loved him, but I didn't need him. And I thought that was the way it was supposed to be. A ghost bird might be a hawk in one place, a crow in another, depending on the context. The sparrow that shot up into the blue sky one morning might transform mid-flight into an osprey the next. This was the way of things here. There were no reasons so mighty that they could override the desire to be in accord with the tides and the passage of seasons and the rhythms underlying everything around me. The journals and other materials formed a moldering pile about 12 feet high and 16 feet wide that in places near the bottom had clearly turned to compost, the paper rotting away. Beetles and silverfish tended to those archives, and tiny black cockroaches with always moving antennae. Toward the base and spilling out at the edges, I saw the remains of photographs and dozens of ruined cassette tapes mixed in with the mulch of pages. There, too, I saw evidence of rats. I would have to lower myself down into the midden by means of the ladder nailed to the lip of the trapdoor and trudge through a collapsing garbage hill of disintegrating pulp to uncover anything at all. The scene obliquely embodied the scrap of writing I had encountered on the tower wall. The seeds of the dead to share with the worms that gather in the darkness and surround the world with the power of their lives. I overturned the table and laid it across the narrow entrance to the stairwell. I had no idea where the psychologist had gotten to, but I didn't want her or anyone else surprising me. If someone tried to move the table from below, I would hear it and have time to climb up to greet them with my gun. I also had a sensation I can, in hindsight, attribute to the brightness growing within me, of a presence pressing up from below, impinging on the edges of my senses. A prickling crept across my skin at unexpected times, for no good reason. I didn't like that the psychologist had stashed all of her gear down with the journals, including what appeared to be most or all of her weapons. For the moment, though, I had to put the puzzle of that out of my mind, along with the still reverberating tremors from the certain knowledge that most of the training the Southern Reach had given us had been based on a lie. As I lowered myself into that cool, dark, sheltered space beneath, I felt the pull of the brightness within me even more acutely. That was harder to ignore, since I didn't know what it meant. My flashlight, along with the natural light from the open trap door, revealed that the walls of the room were rife with striations of mold, some of which formed dull stripes of red and green. From below, the way the midden spilled out in ripples and hillocks of paper became more apparent. Torn pages, crushed pages, journal covers warped and damp. Slowly, the history of exploring Area X could be said to be turning into Area X. I picked around the edges at first, chose journals at random. Most, at a glance, depicted quite ordinary events, such as those described by the first expedition, which could not have been the first expedition. Some were extraordinary only because the dates did not make sense. How many expeditions had really come across the border? Just how much information had been doctored and suppressed? And for how long? Did 12 expeditions refer only to the latest iteration of a longer effort, the omission of the rest necessary to quell the doubts of those approached to be volunteers? What I would call pre-expedition accounts, documented in a variety of forms, also existed in that place. This was the underlying archive of audio cassettes, chewed at photographs and decomposing folders full of papers that I had first glimpsed from above, all of it oppressed by the weight of the journals on top, all of it suffused by a dull, damp smell that contained within it a masked, sharp stench of decay, which revealed itself in some places and not others, a bewildering confusion of typewritten, printed, and handwritten words piled up in my head alongside half-seen images like a mental facsimile of the midden itself. The clutter at times brought me close to becoming frozen, even without factoring in the contradictions. I became aware of the weight of the photograph in my pocket. I made some initial rules, as if that would help. I ignored journals that appeared to be written in a shorthand, and did not try to decipher those that appeared to be in code. I also started out reading some journals straight through and then decided to force myself to skim. But sampling was sometimes worse. I came across pages that described unspeakable acts that I still cannot bring myself to set down in words, entries that mentioned periods of remission and cessation, followed by flare-ups and horrible manifestations. No matter how long Area X had existed and how many expeditions had come here, I could tell from these accounts that for years before there had ever been a border, strange things had happened along this coast. There had been a proto-Area X. Some types of omissions made my mind itch as much as more explicit offerings. One journal, half destroyed by the damp, focused solely on the qualities of a kind of thistle with a lavender blossom that grew in the hinterlands between forest and swamp. Page after page described encountering first one specimen of this thistle and then another, along with minute details about the insects and other creatures that occupied that microhabitat. In no instance did the observer stray more than a foot or two from a particular plant, and at no point either did the observer pull back to provide a glimpse of base camp or their own life. After a while, kind of unease came over me as I began to perceive a terrible presence hovering in the background of these entries. I saw the crawler, or some surrogate, approaching in that space just beyond the thistle, and the single focus of the journal keeper a way of coping with that horror. An absence is not a presence, but still, with each new depiction of a thistle, a shiver worked deeper and deeper into my spine. When the latter part of the book dissolved into ruined ink and moist pulp, I was almost relieved to be rid of that unnerving repetition, for there had been a hypnotic, trance-like quality to the accounts. If there had been an endless number of pages, I feared that I would have stood there reading for an eternity, until I fell to the floor and died of thirst or starvation. I began to wonder if the absence of references to the tower fit this theory as well, this writing around the edges of things. In the black water of the sun shining at midnight, those fruit shall come ripe. Then I found, after several banal or incomprehensible samples, a journal that wasn't the same type as my own. It dated back to before the first expedition, but after the border had come down, and referenced building the wall, which clearly meant the fortification facing the sea. A page later, mixed in with esoteric meteorological readings, three words leapt out at me: repelling an attack. I read the next few entries with care. The writer at first made no reference to the nature of the attack or the identity of the attackers, but the assault had come from the sea and left four of us dead, although the wall had held. Later, the sense of desperation grew, and I read, "The desolation comes from the sea again, along with the strange lights and the marine life that at high tide batters itself against our wall. At night now, their outliers try to creep in through the gaps in our wall defenses. Still we hold, but our ammunition is running out. Some of us want to abandon the lighthouse, try for either the island or inland, but the commander says he has his orders. Morale is low. Not everything that is happening to us has a rational explanation." Soon after, the account trails off. It had a distinctly unreal quality to it, as if a fictionalized version of real events. I tried to imagine what Area X might have looked like so long ago. I couldn't. The lighthouse had drawn expedition members like the ships it had once sought to bring to safety through the narrows and reefs offshore. I could only underscore my previous speculation that to most of them a lighthouse was a symbol, a reassurance of the old order, and by its prominence on the horizon, it provided an illusion of a safe refuge. That it had betrayed that trust was manifest in what I found downstairs, and yet even though some of them must have known that, still they had come, out of hope, out of faith, out of stupidity. But I had begun to realize that you had to wage a guerrilla war against whatever force had come to inhabit Area X if you wanted to fight at all. You had to fade into the landscape, or like the writer of the Thistle Chronicles, you had to pretend it wasn't there for as long as possible. To acknowledge it, to try to name it, might be a way of letting it in. For the same reason, I suppose, I have continued to refer to the changes in me as a brightness, because to examine this condition too closely, to quantify it or deal with it empirically when I have little control over it, would make it too real. At some point, I began to panic at the sheer volume of what remained in front of me, and in my panic, I refined my focus further. I would search only for phrases identical to or similar in tone to the words on the wall of the tower. I started to assail the hill of paper more directly, to wade into the middle sections, the rectangle of light above me, a reassurance that this was not the sum of my existence. I rummaged like the rats and the silverfish. I shoved my arms into the mess and came out holding whatever my hands could grasp. At times, I lost my balance and became buried in the papers, wrestled with them, my nostrils full of rot, my tongue tasting it. I would have looked unhinged to anyone watching from above, and I knew it even as I engaged in this frenzied, futile activity. But I found what I was looking for in more journals than I would have expected, and usually it was that beginning phrase, "Where lies the strangling fruit that came from the hand of the sinner? I shall bring forth the seeds of the dead to share with the worms." Often it appeared as a scrawled margin note, or in other ways disconnected from the text around it. Once I discovered it documented as a phrase on the wall of the lighthouse itself, which we quickly washed away with no reason given. Another time, in a spidery hand, I found a reference to text in a logbook that reads as if it came out of the Old Testament, but is from no psalm I remember. How could this not refer to the crawler's writing? To share with the worms that gather in the darkness and surround the world with the power of their lives. But none of this placed me any closer to understanding why or who. We were all in the dark, scrabbling at the pile of journals. And if ever I felt the weight of my predecessors, it was there and then, lost in it all. At a certain point I discovered I was so overwhelmed I could not continue, could not even go through the motions. It was too much data, served up in too anecdotal a form. I could search those pages for years and perhaps never uncover the right secrets, while caught in a loop of wondering how long this place had existed, who had first left their journals here, why others had followed suit, until it had become as inexorable as a long ingrained ritual. By what impulse, what shared fatalism? All I really thought I knew was that the journals from certain expeditions and certain individual expedition members were missing, that the record was incomplete. I was also aware that I would have to go back to base camp before nightfall or remain at the lighthouse. I didn't like the idea of traveling in the dark, and if I didn't return, I had no guarantee the surveyor wouldn't abandon me and try to recross the border. For now, I decided on one last effort. With great difficulty, I climbed to the top of the midden, trying hard not to dislodge journals as I did so. It was a kind of roiling, moving monster beneath my boots, unwilling, like the sand of the dunes outside, to allow my tread without an equal and opposite reaction. But I made it up there anyway. As I imagined, journals on the top of the mass were more recent, and I immediately found the ones written by members of my husband's expedition. With a kind of lurch in my stomach, I kept rummaging, knowing that it was inevitable what I would stumble upon, and I was right. Stuck to the back of another journal by dried blood or some other substance, I found it more easily than I'd imagined. My husband's journal, written in the confident, bold handwriting I knew from birthday cards, notes on the refrigerator, and shopping lists. The ghost bird had found his ghost on an inexplicable pile of other ghosts. But rather than looking forward to reading that account, I felt as if I were stealing a private diary that had been locked by his death. A stupid feeling, I know. All he ever wanted was for me to open up to him, and as a result, he had always been there for the taking. Now, though, I would have to take him as I found him, and it would probably be forever, and I found the truth of that intolerable. I could not bring myself to read it yet, but fought the urge to throw my husband's journal back on the pile and put it instead with the handful of other journals I planned to take back to base camp with me. I also retrieved two of the psychologist's guns as I climbed up out of that wretched space. I left her other supplies there for now. It might be useful to have a cache in the lighthouse. It was later than I had thought when I emerged from below, the sky taking on the deep amber hue that marked the beginning of late afternoon. The sea was ablaze with light, but nothing beautiful here fooled me any more. Human lives had poured into this place over time, volunteered to become party to exile and worse. Under everything lay the ghastly presence of countless desperate struggles. Why did they keep sending us? Why do we keep going? So many lies, so little ability to face the truth. Area X broke minds, I felt, even though it hadn't yet broken mine. A line from a song kept coming back to me. All this useless knowledge. After being in that space for so long, I needed fresh air and the feel of the wind. I dropped what I'd taken into a chair and opened the sliding door to walk out onto the circular ledge bounded by a railing. The wind tore at my clothes and slapped against my face. The sudden chill was cleansing and the view even better. I could see forever from there. But after a moment, some instinct or premonition made me look straight down, past the remains of the defensive wall, to the beach, part of which was half hidden by the curve of the dune, the height of the wall, even from that angle. Emerging from that space was a foot and the end of a leg, amid a flurry of disrupted sand. I trained my binoculars on the foot. It lay unmoving, a familiar pant leg, a familiar boot, with the laces double-tied and even. I gripped the railing tight to counter a feeling of vertigo. I knew the owner of that boot. It was the psychologist. 4. Immersion. Everything I knew about the psychologist came from my observations during training. She had served both as a kind of distant overseer and in a more personal role as our confessor, except I had nothing to confess. Perhaps I confessed more under hypnosis, but during our regular sessions, which I had agreed to as a condition of being accepted for the expedition, I volunteered little. "Tell me about your parents. What are they like?" she asked, a classic opening gambit. "Normal," I replied, trying to smile while thinking distant, impractical, irrelevant, moody, useless. "Your mother is an alcoholic, correct, and your father is a kind of con man?" I almost exhibited a lack of control at what seemed like an insult, not an insight. I almost protested, defiantly. "My mother is an artist and my father is an entrepreneur." "What are your earliest memories?" "Breakfast." Stuffed puppy toy I still have today. Putting a magnifying glass up to an antlion's sinkhole. Kissing a boy and making him strip for me because I didn't know any better. Falling into a fountain and banging my head. The result, 5 stitches in the emergency room and an abiding fear of drowning. In the emergency room again when Mom drank too much. Followed by the relief of almost a year of sobriety. Of all of my answers, breakfast annoyed her the most. I could see it in the corner of her mouth, fighting a downward turn, her rigid stance, the coldness in her eyes. But she kept her control. "Did you have a happy childhood?" "Normal," I replied. My mom once so out of it, that she poured orange juice into my cereal instead of milk. My dad's incessant, nervous chatter, which made him seem perpetually guilty of something. Cheap motels for vacations by the beach, where Mom would cry at the end because we had to go back to the normal strapped-for-cash life, even though we'd never really left it. That sense of impending doom occupying the car. "How close were you to your extended family?" "Close enough." Birthday card suitable for a 5-year-old even when I was 20. Visits once every couple of years. A kindly grandfather with long yellow fingernails and the voice of a bear, a grandmother who lectured on the value of religion and saving your pennies. What were their names? How do you feel about being part of a team? Just fine. I've often been part of teams. And by part of, I mean off to the side. You let go from a number of your field jobs. Do you want to tell me why? She knew why, so again I shrugged and said nothing. Are you agreeing to join this expedition because of your husband? How close were you and your husband? How often did you fight? Why did you fight? Why didn't you call the authorities the moment he returned to your house? These sessions clearly frustrated the psychologist on a professional level, on the level of her ingrained training, which was predicated on drawing personal information out of patients in order to establish trust and then delve into deeper issues. But on another level, I could never quite grasp. She seemed to approve of my answers. "You're very self-contained," she said once, but not as a pejorative. It was only as we walked for a second day from the border toward base camp that it struck me that perhaps the very qualities she might disapprove of from a psychiatric point of view made me suitable for the expedition. Now she sat propped up against a mound of sand, sheltered by the shadow of the wall in a kind of broken pile, one leg straight out, the other trapped beneath her. She was alone. I could see from her condition and the shape of the impact that she had jumped or been pushed from the top of the lighthouse. She probably hadn't quite cleared the wall, been hurt by it on the way down, while I, in my methodical way, had spent hours going through the journals. She had been lying here the whole time. What I couldn't understand was why she was still alive. Her jacket and shirt were covered in blood, but she was breathing and her eyes were open, looking out toward the ocean as I knelt beside her. She had a gun in her left hand, left arm outstretched, and I gently took the weapon from her, tossed it to the side, just in case. The psychologist did not seem to register my presence. I touched her gently on one broad shoulder, and then she screamed, lunged away, falling over as I recoiled. "Annihilation!" she shrieked at me, flailing in confusion. "Annihilation! Annihilation!" The word seemed more meaningless the more she repeated it, like the cry of a bird with a broken wing. "It's just me, the biologist," I said in a calm voice, even though she had rattled me. "Just you," she said with a wheezing chuckle, as if I'd said something funny. "Just you." As I propped her up again, I heard a kind of creaking groan and realized she had probably broken most of her ribs. Her left arm and shoulder felt spongy under her jacket. Dark blood was seeping out around her stomach. Beneath the hand she had instinctively pressed down on that spot, I could smell that she had pissed herself. "You're still here," she said, surprise in her voice. "But I killed you, didn't I?" The voice of someone waking from a dream or falling into dream. Not even a little bit. A rough wheeze again, and the film of confusion leaving her eyes. "Did you bring water? I'm thirsty." I did, and I pressed my canteen to her mouth so she could swallow a few gulps. Drops of blood glistened on her chin. "Where is the surveyor?" the psychologist asked in a gasp. "Back at the base camp."
"Wouldn't come with you?"
"No." The wind was blowing back the curls of her hair, revealing a slashing wound on her forehead, possibly from impact with the wall above.
"Didn't like your company?" the psychologist asked. "Didn't like what you've become?"
A chill came over me. "I'm the same as always." The psychologist's gaze drifted out to sea again.
"I saw you, you know, coming down the trail toward the lighthouse. That's how I knew for sure you had changed."
"What did you see?" I asked, to humor her. A cough accompanied by red spittle.
"You were aflame," she said,
and I had a brief vision of my brightness made manifest.
"You were aflame, scorching my gaze. A flame drifting across the salt flats, through the ruined village. A slow-burning flame, a will-o'-the-wisp floating across the marsh and the dunes, floating and floating, like nothing human but something free and floating.
From the shift in her tone, I recognized that even now she was trying to hypnotize me. "It won't work," I said. "I'm immune to hypnosis now." Her mouth opened, then closed, then opened again.
"Of course you are. You were always difficult," she said, as if talking to a child.
Was that an odd sense of pride in her voice? Perhaps I should have left the psychologist alone, let her die without providing any answers, but I could not find that level of grace within me. A thought occurred. If I had looked so inhuman, why didn't you shoot me dead as I approached?
An unintentional leer as she swiveled her head to stare at me, unable to control all of the muscles in her face. My arm, my hand, wouldn't let me pull the trigger.
That sounded delusional to me, and I had seen no sign of an abandoned rifle beside the beacon. I tried again.
"And your fall? Pushed, or an accident, or on purpose?"
A frown appeared, a true perplexity expressed through the network of wrinkles at the corners of her eyes, as if the memory were only coming through in fragments.
I thought something was after me. I tried to shoot you and couldn't, and then you were inside. Then I thought I saw something behind me, coming toward me from the stairs, and I felt such an overwhelming fear. I had to get away from it, so I jumped out over the railing. I jumped.
As if she couldn't believe she had done such a thing. What did the thing coming after you look like? A coughing fit, words dribbling out around the edges.
I never saw it. It was never there. Or I saw it too many times. It was inside me, inside you. I was trying to get away from what's inside me.
I didn't believe any part of that fragmented explanation at the time, which seemed to imply something had followed her from the tower. I interpreted the frenzy of her disassociation as part of a need for control. She had lost control of the expedition, and so she had to find someone or something to blame her failure on, no matter how improbable. I tried a different approach. "Why did you take the anthropologist down into the tunnel in the middle of the night? What happened there?" She hesitated, but I couldn't tell if it was from caution or because something inside her body was breaking down. Then she said,
"A miscalculation, impatience. I needed intel before we risked the whole mission. I needed to know where we stood."
"You mean the progress of the crawler?"
She smiled wickedly. "Is that what you call it, the crawler?"
"What happened?" I asked.
"What do you think happened? It all went wrong. The anthropologist got too close."
Translation: the psychologist had forced her to get close.
"The thing reacted. It killed her. Wounded me."
"Which is why you looked so shaken the next morning."
"Yes, and because I could tell that you were already changing."
"I'm not changing," I shouted it, an unexpected rage rising inside of me. A wet chuckle, a mocking tone.
"Of course you're not. You're just becoming more of what you've always been. And I'm not changing either. None of us are changing. Everything is fine. Let's have a picnic."
"Shut up. Why did you abandon us?"
"The expedition had been compromised."
"That isn't an explanation."
"Did you ever give me a proper explanation during training?"
"We hadn't been compromised, not enough to abandon the mission."
"6 day after reaching base camp, and one person is dead, two already changing, the fourth wavering. I would call that a disaster."
"If it was a disaster, you helped create it." I realized that as much as I mistrusted the psychologist personally, I had come to rely on her to lead the expedition. On some level, I was furious that she had betrayed us. Furious that she might be leaving me now.
"You just panicked, and you gave up."
The psychologist nodded.
"That, too, I did. I did. I should have recognized earlier that you had changed. I should have sent you back to the border. I shouldn't have gone down there with the anthropologist. But here we are.
She grimaced, coughed out a thick wetness. I ignored the jab, changed the line of questioning. What does the border look like? That smile again.
I'll tell you when I get there.
What really happens when we cross over?
Not what you might expect.
Tell me, what do we cross through? I felt as if I were getting lost again. There was a gleam in her eye now that I did not like, that promised damage.
I want you to think about something. You might be immune to hypnosis. You might. But what about the veil already in place? What if I removed that veil so you could access your own memories of crossing the border?
The psychologist asked.
Would you like that, little flame? Would you like it, or would you go mad?
If you try to do anything to me, I'll kill you, I said, and meant it. The thought of hypnosis in general and the conditioning behind it had been difficult for me, an invasive price to be paid in return for access to Area X. The thought of further tampering was intolerable.
How many of your memories do you think are implanted? The psychologist asked. How many of your memories of the world beyond the border are verifiable?
That won't work on me, I told her. I am sure of the here and now, this moment and the next. I am sure of my past. That was Ghostbird's Castle Keep, and it was inviolate. It might have been punctured by the hypnosis during training, but it had not been breached. Of this I was certain, and would continue to be certain, because I had no choice.
I'm sure your husband felt the same way before the end, the psychologist said.
I sat back on my haunches, staring at her. I wanted to leave her before she poisoned me, but I couldn't.
Let's stick to your own hallucinations, I said. Describe the crawler to me. There are things you must see with your own eyes. You might get closer. You might be more familiar to it.
Her lack of regard for the anthropologist's fate was hideous, but so was mine. What did you hide from us about Area X?
Too general a question.
I think it amused the psychologist, even dying, for me to so desperately need answers from her. Okay, then. What do the black boxes measure?
Nothing. They don't measure anything. It's just a psychological ploy to keep the expedition calm. No red light, no danger.
What is the secret behind the tower?
The tunnel? If we knew, do you think we would keep sending in expeditions?
They're scared. The Southern Reach.
That is my impression.
Then they have no answers.
I'll give you this scrap. The border is advancing, for now. Slowly, a little bit more every year. In ways you wouldn't expect. But maybe, soon, it'll eat a mile or two at a time.
The thought of that silenced me for a long moment. When you're too close to the center of a mystery, there is no way to pull back and see the shape of it entire. The black boxes might do nothing, but in my mind they were all blinking red. How many expeditions have there been?
Ah, the journals, she said. There are quite a lot of them, aren't there?
That doesn't answer my question.
Maybe I don't know the answer. Maybe I just don't want to tell you.
It was going to continue this way to the end, and there wasn't anything I could do about it. What did the first expedition really find? The psychologist grimaced, and not from her pain this time, but more as if she were remembering something that caused her shame.
There's video from that expedition, of a sort. The main reason no advanced tech was allowed after that.
Video? Somehow, after searching through the mound of journals, that information didn't startle me. I kept moving forward. What orders didn't you reveal to us?
You're beginning to bore me, and I'm beginning to fade a little. Sometimes we tell you more, sometimes less. They have their metrics and their reasons.
Somehow, the they felt made of cardboard, as if she didn't quite believe in them. Reluctantly, I returned to the personal. What do you know about my husband?
Nothing more than you'll find out from reading his journal. Have you found it yet?
No, I lied. Very insightful. About you, especially. Was that a bluff? She'd certainly had time enough up in the lighthouse to find it, read it, and toss it back onto the pile. It didn't matter. The sky was darkening and encroaching, the waves deepening, the surf making the shorebirds scatter on their stilt legs and then regroup as it receded. The sand seemed suddenly more porous around us. The meandering paths of crabs and worms continued to be written into its surface. A whole community lived here, was going about its business, oblivious to our conversation. And where out there lay the seaward border? When I had asked the psychologist during training, she had said only that no one had ever crossed it, and I had imagined expeditions that just evaporated into mist and light and distance. A rattle had entered the psychologist's breathing, which was now shallow and inconsistent. "Is there anything I can do to make you more comfortable?" Relenting. "Leave me here when I die," she said. Now all her fear was visible. "Don't bury me. Don't take me anywhere. Leave me here where I belong." "Is there anything else you're willing to tell me?"
"We should never have come here. I should never have come here."
The rawness in her tone hinted at a personal anguish that went beyond her physical condition. "That's all?"
"I've come to believe it is the one fundamental truth."
I took it to mean that it was better to let the border advance, to ignore it, let it affect some other, more distant generation. I didn't agree with her, but I said nothing. Later, I would come to believe she had meant something altogether different. Has anyone ever really come back from Area X?
"Not for a long time now," the psychologist said in a tired whisper. "Not really."
But I don't know if she had heard the question. Her head sagged downward, and she lost consciousness, then came to again and stared out at the waves. She muttered a few words, one of which might have been remote or demote, and another that might have been hatching or watching. But I could not be sure. Soon dusk would descend. I gave her more water. It was hard to think of her as an adversary the closer she came to death, even though clearly she knew so much more than she had told me. Regardless, did not bear much thought, because she wasn't going to divulge anything else. And maybe I had looked like a flame as I came near. Maybe that was the only way she could think of me now. "Did you know about the pile of journals?" I asked, "before we came here?" But she did not answer. There were things I had to do after she died, even though I was running short of daylight, even though I did not like doing them. If she wouldn't answer my questions while alive, then she would have to answer some of them now. I took off the psychologist's jacket and laid it to the side, discovering in the process that she had hidden her own journal in a zippered inside pocket, folded up. I put that to the side, too, under a stone, the pages flapping in the gusts of wind. Then I took out my penknife and, with great care, cut away the left sleeve of her shirt. The sponginess of her shoulder had bothered me, and I saw I had good reason to be concerned. From her collarbone down to her elbow, her arm had been colonized by a fibrous green-gold fuzziness which gave off a faint glow. From the indentations and long rift running down her triceps, it appeared to have spread from an initial wound, the wound she said she had received from the crawler. Whatever had contaminated me, this different and more direct contact had spread faster and had more disastrous consequences. Certain parasites and fruiting bodies could cause not just paranoia but schizophrenia, all too realistic hallucinations, and thus promote delusional behavior. I had no doubt now that she had seen me as a flame approaching, that she had attributed her inability to shoot me to some exterior force, that she had been assailed by the fear of some approaching presence. If nothing else, the memory of the encounter with the crawler would, I imagined, have unhinged her to some degree. I cut a skin sample from her arm, along with some of the flesh beneath, and prodded it into a collection vial. Then I took another sample from her other arm. Once I got back to base camp, I would examine both. I was shaking a little by then, so I took a break.